Hey, just right now, I want you to realize that you're listening to Real on the Field Goals. If you're doing so on the podcast app and you have not subscribed within the last week, you need to resubscribe to Real on the Field Goals. This is why I want to say this right at the top. There is a new feed for Real on the Field Goals. So if you're listening to this on the podcast, you're actually subscribed to Deep Balls and you stay subscribed to that. But then go to your iTunes and search for Real in the Field Goals. Subscribe to that one. It's got the icon that is green and brown and says Real in the Field Goals. Subscribe to that. And that's where you'll be getting these. And we're going to say this probably this will be the last week that we put it on the other feed. So if you want to get that immediate reaction this week after the Seahawks play the Packers, please subscribe to Real in the Field Goals. Give it a 5-star rating and keep listening. And remember, Real on the Field Goals is twice a week. We're going to do these on Thursdays and then immediately following games to talk about what we just saw. So I wanted to say that right at the top. Now let's get into a little bit of the advertising game here real quick. Real on the Field Goals is brought to you by the Ballard Agency in Kirkland, Washington. They're a brokerage firm that has been doing this for over 50 years, and it's all been with one family, the Ballards. And handed down from father to son. And what do you want to know what makes them different than other brokerage firms there, Danny?
What?
Well, they have access to numerous top-rated insurance carriers to make sure that your business and personal insurance needs are matched to the carrier that best meets those needs. And when circumstances change, you don't have to go looking for a new agent. You can find a new carrier and stay with the same person that already knows you and your company. How does that sound?
That actually sounds really good. I like that a lot.
Remember, business insurance, personal insurance, all these things. The other day, I just found out there's alien abduction insurance. Did you know that?
There really is? That's pretty sweet.
There really is. And it's. I think it's actually quite expensive. But, so that you can get – I don't know if they can help you get alien abduction insurance, but if you need the other kinds of insurance, the ones that are less valid, like car insurance or
– boring.
Or, that you're – $50 million company is insured, then go to the Ballard Agency. And remember that jingle, 425-454-3510. Tell them Field Goal sent you. And let's get going on right now on Real in the Field Goals. It is September 17th, 2015. It's Thursday, and the Seahawks are preparing to go to Green Bay to atone for their loss in St. Louis last week. I'm Kenneth Arthur, and with me is Danny Kelly. Danny, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well, Kenny. It sounds like you're jacked up and ready to do this thing.
I'm jacked up, and I'm raring to go. I'm on another one, everybody. I am definitely jacked up. I listened to Deep Balls yesterday. I may have skipped forward to the part where you talked about the Seahawks, but I did go back and listen to the rest.
Okay.
You picked the Seahawks to win the game.
Correct? I did. Yes, I did.
You want to just go ahead and tell us again why you genuinely believe that and not just from a fan perspective.
Well, genuinely do believe it. I don't genuinely believe it really, really strongly, but I'm kind of going with it this week. I think the Seahawks are going to run well this week. I think the Packers are not a good run defense team. They gave up 189 yards last week. To the Bears, and in the last two games the Seahawks have played them, they've averaged over 200 yards per game rushing, which is kind of absurd. So I think they're going to run the ball really well. I think they'll control the ball because of that. And I think that the defense is going to clean some of the stuff up that happened last week. And at the end of the day, it's probably going to look more like an aberration in week one than like where they're going this year, I think.
Right.
So, those are the reasons that I picked the Seahawks, and I think it's going to be a really tough game. But, you have to pick one team, and that's what I did.
Yeah. I would say that over the last 3 years, they are 3-0 against Green Bay. Obviously, home field advantage plays a big role in that, especially two of those games were incredibly close, probably two of the closest games in Pete Carroll's career. But at the same time, still 3-0, they did pull it off, and that at least gives me some hope that they've got the matchups. Even without Cam Chancellor, they've got the matchups to turn down what Aaron Rodgers is able to do, especially without Jordy Nelson in there. That's going to be the most exciting thing to possibly see. But they also were one of the worst teams against the run last week. I mean, Matt Forte is a good player, but he really looked like mid-form, mid-season Matt Forte playing against the Packers in week one. Do you think that Marshawn Lynch is going to be able to? He's had a good run against the Packers in these last few games. Do you expect Marshawn Lynch to maybe get that old POTG, player of the game?
Yeah, the old POTG. Yeah, I think he's going to run a lot better this week. I think obviously he didn't run terrible last week. He averaged, I think, 4.1 yards per carry against the Rams, which is pretty good considering that line. Had a couple big runs. And I can see them, you know, doing that again this year. Sorry, this week. I think the offensive line is going to have an easier day of it. Obviously, nothing's easy in the NFL, but when you're not facing Aaron Donald, you know, and four other first-round picks on the defensive line, it just makes things a little easier. I think another week of, you know, continuity and communication improvements, things like that, these guys are going to get better, I think, as the year goes on. As they play together and get used to playing next to each other. And so I think overall it's going to be good. I think it's going to be better in the run game. It's always a little bit difficult to run against a 3-4 team. Mm-hmm. But the Packers did just lose Sam Barrington at inside linebacker, so that'll be interesting to see if that hurts. I was talking to Tex Western from the Acme Packing Company. That's the SB Nation blog for the Packers over there. And he was saying that he was a much better run defender, but the guy who's going to fill in for him is a little bit better in the pasty. So maybe a little bit of give and take there, but I could see the Seahawks really running a lot this week and kind of getting back to their identity a little bit more than they were last week with, 41 passes and things like that. It could be a little different this week.
Yeah. And it's going to be really interesting. Like you say, not really going to be often facing a defensive line like that, arguably the best defensive line in the NFL. Something that John Clayton said on KJR this week was that they might not face another good defensive line until December with the Baltimore Ravens, and they just lost Terrell Suggs. Just going game by game, and it's like, you know, me and you were pretty, I think we're pretty adept on who's on what teams. So if I just go through this list real quick, I mean, just tell me, do these guys have any – how many significant defensive line players do these teams have? The Chicago Bears?
I do like the Chicago Bears line. Do you want me to answer right away or are you going to
go? Yeah, go ahead. That's what I'm looking for.
Pernell McPhee, he's not necessarily a lineman, but he's a front seven guy. And then they have also Will Sutton, who's kind of an interesting player.
Yeah.
Ego Ferguson is he's an LSU guy from a couple years ago that is pretty good. And then they got a guy, Jarvis Jenkins from Washington. Willie Young's a good pass rusher.
Sounds like you like the potential more so than
I think that's an accurate way of putting it.
Yeah, these guys I like, you know, if you talk about Will Sutton at one time considered maybe a first round pick out of Arizona State, you know, there are potential there, but they did give up a lot of rushing yards as well last week. To the Green Bay Packers, they gave up 133 rushing yards. Better in the pass defense, surprisingly enough, 189 yards passing that they had given up.
And to me, they're not like – I'm not saying they're an elite defense or defensive line or anything.
Right.
Like that, but there's a few guys on that line I do like.
The Detroit Lions, they lost Sue. They lost Fairley. They got Ezekiel Ansah.
Yep, that's the big one, I think. Obviously, kind of – will it be interesting to see what happens with Haloti Ngata replacing Sue, sort of. I know that they, you know, Tyron Walker was a little bit underrated and that people talked about him this offseason as kind of an underrated signing. He was a rotational guy for the Saints last year before he signed with the Lions. And then people from Seattle remember Jason Jones, Daryl Tapp, and then, you know, there's a couple other guys on that line that are interesting, but they're definitely not how they're not as good as they were last year, of course.
Haloti Ngata, questionable this week with a shoulder injury. They're banged up all over. Guard Larry Warford, questionable. DeAndre Levy, questionable. Golden Tate, probable. Darius Slake, probable. So they're banged up. We'll see how they do in 3 weeks when they come to Seattle. Anything could change between now and then.
Yep.
Then you got the Cincinnati Bengals. Obviously, they have Geno.
Yep. I think that's actually a really good defensive line. Carlos Dunlap is really underrated. I like Domata Peko. He's kind of a fun guy to play or to watch play.
I think you're just an optimist, man.
Well, that's potentially that's true. But I actually think that the Bengals, of all these teams you've named so far, they have a really good defense.
What about the Carolina Panthers?
Well, obviously their defense is really good too. The defensive line for the Panthers is kind of their identity, actually, other than Luke Kuechly. But, you know, you got Charles Johnson, Kwon Short, Starlet Lavey, and Dwan Edwards.
Yeah, now I'm starting to question John Clayton's entire MO here.
I think, okay, the Bears, that's fine. I agree with that. The Lions, that's fine. I don't think they're anything special right now. I would say the Bengals and Panthers have good defensive lines.
The 49ers, they lost, you know, a lot of players.
Yeah, it's not the same. It's not the same in San Francisco. I think they have good players. It's not a great line.
So, Jim Tomsula is a defensive line coach, so he might be working specifically and especially to make them better. The Dallas Cowboys, they will have Greg Hardy back by then.
Oh, okay. Their defensive line is, you know, nothing to be terrified of. I don't think Tom Crawford is really good. Apart from that, you got like Randy Gregory and DeMarcus Lawrence at defensive ends. And then having Greg Hardy get back, that's going to be big for them. But, you know, he's not played in forever, so we'll see how he does.
But obviously, this is a team that you look at a lot, the Arizona Cardinals. You know, what's interesting about them is that they got this great defense and all. It's just crazy to me that they haven't had Darrell Washington, you know, like he might be the best player on that entire team, not even there. And they're still doing good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the Cardinals have a decent defensive line. I think Calais Campbell is obviously really good. And then past him, there's a lot of kind of role player style guys. And I think they're good, not great.
49ers again, Steelers. They've got a bad defense.
Yeah, I mean, they looked really bad week one against the Patriots. I talked about this a few different times. They just didn't really do anything that impressive on defense. That their offense is kind of more their identity this year, I think, and they're really young on defense and trying to figure things out. They were nothing too impressive.
A lot of us watched the Minnesota Vikings on Monday night, got a closer look at that defense.
The Vikings were supposed to have a better defense than what they kind of showed week one. I think during the, you know, first quarter, it was ugly and both teams kind of looked terrible. On paper, I really like the Vikings defensive line, you know, with Sharif Floyd and Everson Griffin are both really good players. And then Linval Joseph is a good player. They have some good guys. I just think they didn't show up in week one, so we don't really know exactly what they are yet.
I would say that, you know, looking at this schedule, it definitely seems to be that the Seahawks are going to be facing more good defenses than they are good offenses. There's going to be more teams that are like, the strength is definitely on the defensive side of the ball. So they're going to have to figure out, I think, better ways to score, because it seems like they could be in a lot of low scoring games, even though they just came off a 34-31 game. If I look at teams like the Bears, maybe, I don't know what the Bears are. I can't even comment.
We don't know what the Bears are yet, I don't think.
Yeah, the Lions, I think, obviously last year they were much more about defense. They have good players on offense, but it doesn't really click.
Right.
The Bengals, defense, definitely. The Panthers, defense, definitely. The 49ers, maybe, you know, it depends. Carlos Hyde looked pretty good, didn't he?
Yeah, their run game might be their identity.
Yeah.
I think we could say their defense is probably better than their offense if we're really going to have to decide.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. And the Dallas Cowboys
gave up like three, I think, to the Vikings, if that. I can't remember, but yeah.
Yeah.
They look pretty good.
The Cowboys, obviously, but they just lost Dez Bryant for maybe the whole season.
Yeah, the Cowboys their identity is definitely their offense. Their defense is kind of middling to worse.
It's all on Tony Romo now.
Pretty much, yeah.
Cardinals defense, 49ers. Steelers offense for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Vikings defense was supposed to be, I thought, you know, that was what we all expected.
Yeah, I mean, they still have a rookie, second-year quarterback in Teddy Bridgewater. He did not look good week one, but, you know, he had such a good year last year that you expect they'll probably turn that around. But still, I think, to me, when I think of the Vikings, I think of a really good defense in theory and then, like, an offense that's on the rise. So that's why they're kind of everyone's sleeper this year, I think, is because they have, you know, some weapons on offense. They got Peterson back. I would say, you know, that their defense is their identity more.
The Ravens are in retrograde. I don't know exactly after the loss of Sug. They were supposed to, you know, be defense. They were just such a defense franchise, but I don't know. Ravens might be pretty bad this year. I'm starting to wonder.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're kind of similar to the Bears, or not to the Bears, to the Vikings, in that we don't really know yet who they are. They looked pretty bad against the Broncos, but then again, they also looked pretty good on defense.
Yeah.
So I still am bullish on the Ravens. I think that their offense will bounce back. I think the Broncos have a really good defense, and that kind of was a big part of it. And maybe Flacco didn't have a very good game.
The Browns, definitely a defense team.
Yep. Yeah.
The Rams, defense for sure.
Yep.
Not last week. They had plenty of offense.
Yeah.
And the Cardinals. You know, it's interesting, though, at least. If there's one benefit to – if the Seahawks can come out of these first two games 1-1, it'll be huge.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then they'll have – you know, and if you get those two away games out of the way, that means, hey, 8 of their last 14 games are at home, so that's something.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, the one, it gets a little bit easier. I don't think any game is easy in, you know, the NFL, especially on the Seahawks schedule. But, yeah, they definitely – this is a rough patch right now. So getting a win this week would be enormous for them. I think, you know, we could be seeing them going 0-2 here. To start the year, and I'm sure people will start panicking, but I think when we were looking at the schedule, like everyone was saying, like, oh, that's rough. Like two road games to start the year, two tough opponents.
Yeah, so we might have to start a segment on Real on the Field Goals that's like the panic corner where we just all freak out. last year, looking at the Packers defense, what's that?
Just play the siren for a few seconds.
Oh, yeah, that's all we'll do.
Sky around siren.
Last year the Packers were 16th on defense in DVOA and 22nd in special teams. Do you think that the Packers have a serviceable defense?
You know, they're always so up and down. I don't really know. I think we're still kind of trying to figure that out. I think they're at least somewhere in the middle. And then, you know, depending on the play of some of their core guys, they could definitely get better. But I would put them somewhere in the middle, I think. Of the league in terms of, you know, just like their DVOA and ranking and things like that right now.
Defensive tackle LaTroy Guion is on suspension. Safety Morgan Burnett is out. And defensive end Dayton Jones, who has been had a great outstanding career as of yet, former first-round pick, is coming back from suspension.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the ones to look out for. Any injuries to look out for the Seahawks?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with Darrell Simon. I think he would play quite a bit if he were healthy, because, as we saw last week, Deshaun Shedd played on the outside when Richard Sherman was playing the nickel. And I think in theory, that Simon would be above Shedd on the depth chart, but we don't really know for sure yet. So I think watch that guy, especially this week, because if he ends up being healthy, then he'll probably play quite a bit. I can't remember who else is. There's a bunch of guys on the list, but no one too major. I'm trying to think.
Obviously, Cam Chancellor will not be playing.
Right.
His holdout continues. How shocked are you that we're at to this point?
I'm really surprised. I actually, you know, I feel kind of bad. People were asking me about it for like the several weeks before, you know, the regular season started, and I kind of was like, whatever, he'll come back. It's just, he's just leveraging the team. That's his only leverage he has.
Yeah.
He'll be back before the games start. I don't think he'll want to miss games, but I was wrong. I really didn't think this was going to come to this. And it was, you know, it's surprising. It's almost like a little bit scary, because if he comes back and he doesn't get any concessions, from the Seahawks, or very few anyway, it's going to look really bad for his agent. Like, his agent could potentially like never get hired again. And so I feel like his agent's probably going to be like really, really determined to not like come back unless they get something, you know what I mean? Yeah. So it kind of depends on what the team does. The agent has to save face here, or else it's really like trouble for his career.
I think at this point they can give up something, because it's not just about getting back on the field, but I think that at this point, if they said they were going to waive the fines or whatever, and that was it, you know, and players would still be deterred from holding out because they don't want to miss games. And the Seahawks have proven that they will be fine with letting you miss games, even your defensive captain. So I think that if you're a player like Michael Bennett or whatever, who I think may just hold out no matter what happens anyway, but I think that if you're a player that's considering, you know, holding out, that you would still have to think twice, even though the fines could get waived. That, you know, they could still say, look, if you hold out and then you come back before week one and you want to play, we're not going to waive your fines. We're just doing this for Cam Chancellor because, you know, he's already missed two games and that's probably punishment enough.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I don't know what they can do. I hope they figure something out. I mean, I'm almost to the point where I would be okay with them kind of like moving some money around or whatever. Like, it wouldn't really bother me. I think they are missing him on defense. And it's a distraction too, you know? So it's, sure. I think it's just frustrating on all accounts, but it'll just be really interesting to see what happens. I don't think he's going to sit out the whole year. I don't really know what that would accomplish, if anything, other than losing millions of dollars.
Yeah, and we'll ask our guest those sort of questions as far as how worried we should be about Deion Bailey having to face off against the Packers' offensive weapons, which are, you know, harder to identify now with James Jones suddenly taking over for Jordy Nelson. And our guest coming up here shortly, Weston Hodkowitz from the Green Bay Press Gazette. So that'll be coming up here very shortly. Is that something that it was pretty amazing, the James Jones story, you know, because
he was on the street, right?
Yeah, he was cut by, not only was he cut first, he was cut by the Raiders, then he was cut by the Giants, then he was just a free agent. And if it wasn't for, you know, it's what I find interesting about these ACL tears is that it's horrible for Jordy Nelson, and it's amazing for somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a new opportunity for someone, and that's what the players always talk about, you know. And I think it just makes a lot of sense. Like, he was in the offense for forever. He knows the offense like the back of his hand. He knows Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers knows him. They know, like, he led the NFL, I think, in touchdowns, or he at least led the Packers.
He had 14, I believe.
Maybe that wasn't the NFL lead, but that was like up there.
I think it was.
And so, I mean, that's a lot. That's saying something. I mean, when was the last time Seahawks had a guy catch 14 touchdowns? I can't even remember.
Yeah, 2012, James Jones had 64 catches for 784 yards and a league-leading 14 touchdowns.
He was just a touchdown maker.
In the two seasons after that, he just had 9 touchdowns with the Packers and then the Raiders. But he did catch 2. And he had a better game than Davante Adams, who a lot of people expected to be the breakout guy. You know,
I think he's taken a little longer to really develop than maybe some people thought he would.
Aaron Rodgers was 9 of 9 on passes to either Cobb or Jones for 3 touchdowns. So that'll be tough to defend.
Yeah, I mean, he's always so good. And I think you were tweeting out some stats earlier. He's like 55 touchdowns to 5 interceptions over the last several years. What was that stat that you tweeted out?
Yeah, that was, I think that's at home since 2012.
That is absurd. I wanted
to compare Russell Wilson to some other guys, and it's 55 touchdowns to 5 interceptions.
I mean, that's just crazy.
Yeah, he's a machine in Green Bay.
And, I mean, it's just so hard to play on the road. That's going to be a hostile crowd, I think. Not hostile in the sense that, like, people are going to be fighting, but they really want, you know, revenge from the NFC Championship, I imagine. And it feels like the Seahawks are a little more on the ropes than they normally are, if you know what I mean. Like, they've been hit, like, and they're like, you know, to use a boxing reference, like, whatever, they're like stunned right now. And I could see the Packers really kind of go for the jugular on this one. And so,
Another stat that I saw the other day was that Aaron Rodgers has in his career has 4 times as many touchdowns as he has interceptions. Mm-hmm. No other quarterback in NFL history has 3 times as many touchdowns as they have interceptions.
Jesus. Yeah, he's the all-time best in the NFL history, right, of touchdown percentage?
Yeah.
I mean, touchdown or interception rate.
I mean, best passer rating in NFL history. Probably, I think he's the only guy with a certain number of passing rating seasons over 100. I mean, everything about him is pretty much signaling that he's the best quarterback of all time.
Yep.
How much of that has to do with, I don't know. I don't think there's anything about system. I don't think it's anything about players. Most of it is just Aaron Rodgers. Over his last, dating back to 2011, he's thrown 142 touchdowns and 25 interceptions. How many times has Eli Manning thrown 25 interceptions? You know, he has a passer rating of 113 over his last 57 games.
Yeah.
It's, and the thing
that people don't realize about Rodgers is he's pretty mobile, too. And he's like, I don't know how to put it. He's a good improviser. He's a good playmaker. He's not just like some guy who stands in the pocket and like throws touchdowns. He's really good at rolling out, escaping pressure, throwing on the run. You know, he's just a really savvy, really, really good quarterback. I really like Aaron Rodgers actually a lot. I hate playing him. It's been crazy how good the Seahawks have been against him, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, he's, like I said, pointed out last year before the NFC Championship game, he did go 0-4 on the road against teams that had good pass defenses, that being the Lions, the Bills, and two times the Seahawks. So that's how you beat the Packers, if you somehow find a way to shut down Aaron Rodgers. But, you know, it doesn't really matter now because he's at home and the Seahawks don't have Cam Chancellor. So let's now call that guy.
All right, dialing now.
Real in the field goals, we're here with Weston Host. I already blew it. Real in the field goals, we're here with Weston Hodkowitz from the Green Bay Press Gazette. How you doing, Weston?
I'm doing good, guys. How are you this fine day?
We are doing well, doing well.
Doing well. As Seahawks fans, could be a little better. We're hoping for a shining light that you can somehow provide by giving us some bad news about the Packers or Aaron Rodgers, but not really expecting it. Let's just start with this. How's the injury situation for the Packers right now? Is Brian Bulaga likely to play or miss the game?
Yeah, as we're speaking right now, not really sure what Bulaga's status is. He did leave practice on Thursday with a knee injury that he sustained right at the end of media availability, and he did not return. Don Barclay, who is coming off an ACL injury of his own, he was the one who replaced him at right tackle. Bulaga has some history there with the knees. He tore his MCL last year. He missed one game, but otherwise played through it. The year before that, he did tear his ACL, and it was, I believe, to his left knee, and I think that's the one they were looking at. So some stuff up in the air right now with Bulaga, but he's a big key to that offensive line. As we saw in last year's opener, when he left, when he first sustained that knee injury, they had to put Derek Sherrod in there, and it did not go very well. Ended up leading to a safety in that game. So that's the one thing right now for the Packers that's kind of up in the air. They also lost their starting inside linebacker, Sam Barrington, to a season-ending foot injury earlier this week. You lose Jordy Nelson to the ACL last month, and the Packers, these injuries are quickly piling up for them.
Yeah, I want to talk about each one of those injuries. Let's first start out with Jordy Nelson. Obviously, the Packers ended up signing James Jones off the street recently, and he did really well in his first game. But I'm curious, from your point of view and your opinion, what did Jordy Nelson bring to the table that James Jones maybe can't bring?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is the big playability. You know, the thing about James Jones, as productive as he was in Green Bay during his 7 years here before he returned, he was mostly a possession receiver, a lot of curls, a lot of stop routes, you know, worked hard for his production, but wasn't really a giant explosive part of this offense. It was more of one of the steadier pieces of it that kept the, you know, down and distance moving. The thing about Nelson is that, you know, I've heard this with so many people I've talked to over the years, is that, you know, he's 6'3", 217 pounds. You put 20 more pounds on him and he'd be an all-pro tight end, a lot of people say, too. I mean, he adds that dimension. They can work him in the slot. He works the boundary. Obviously, you watch any of these sports science highlight reel catches he can make on the sidelines. That was one of the things, the first comments I made after he tore his ACL in Pittsburgh, is that, you know, it doesn't matter about replacing in Green Bay. I mean, few players in the league can do some of the things he does on the sidelines. So, it's a guy that Aaron Rodgers has a lot of trust in. The thing you got to understand about the Packers no huddle is it's all based on Rodgers' trust of receivers and putting balls and knowing that they're, you know, putting balls out there and knowing the receivers are going to go get them and be on their spot. So, that's what you lose with Nelson. I think Jones helps, you know, and he's going to get a lot of one-on-one matchups. He's going to have to be productive, but it takes some of the emphasis away from Randall Cobb. So, even if the New York Giants and the Oakland Raiders passed, it seems like he still has a place here in Green Bay.
Going from 2012 to 2013, James Jones got pretty much just the same number of targets. He played a couple less games, but pretty much the same number of targets, but his touchdowns went down from 14 to 3. and he had two in week one. What exactly changes that about him where suddenly he can be a scoring machine that is unstoppable to defend in the red zone to actually just being able, what could the Seahawks do to be able to hold him down?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I don't know if that had something to do with the fact that, you know, Randall Cobb right now has been limited with that sprained AC joint. Cobb's usually a big target in the red zone. He certainly was the first half of last season where he ended up having 12. Jones in that 2012, I'm trying to think what year that was, where he had the 14 where he led the league. It was kind of an interesting year because he was super productive, but a lot of that had to do with Jordy Nelson being out for four games and being limited and several others with a hamstring injury that just kind of dogged him the entire season. And Jones was sort of the one that became the red zone target there and the favorite for Rodgers. And, you know, maybe to some extent you saw that against Chicago where Rodgers once again was looking his direction. He probably should have had three touchdowns. There was one holding call on David Bakhtiari. He just didn't disengage earlier enough from Jared Allen. If he does that, he probably, you know, I don't think that allowed Rodgers to get the ball off. I think he would have either way. If he gets that third one there, I mean, that really would have, you know, thrown some headlines out there. But, you know, he's 31 years old. I know his coaches here, they say he's quicker, he's leaner. You know, he's still not going to be the same player he was 3 years ago. But with, you know, kind of the hands he's developed over the last 4 years that once was kind of a question for him, I think there is a lot of confidence in this offense in what he can do when given the opportunity.
So obviously the Packers are missing Jordy Nelson. We talked about, you mentioned that Randall Cobb has a bit of an AC joint issue. So he's been on the injury report, but he's expected to play. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is. And the one thing about Chicago, and I know he was asked about this afterwards, if he was used as a decoy in that game. He was saying that if he was, no one told him that. But he still wasn't the same kind of receiver he usually is. He didn't have the full range of motion with his hands. You know, even early on, he caught one pass and ended up going back into the ground pretty hard and was kind of favoring the shoulder again. So I don't know when exactly, you know, those shoulder sprains, they can vary. So we really don't have a full idea of exactly how long he's going to be dealing with this. But I think it's something, once again, especially if you know, the Seahawks throw Richard Sherman on him now in the slot, that's going to be an issue for him trying to obviously get separation but also deal with some of that physicality.
Yeah. Rodgers was 12 of 12 in week one when throwing to Richard Rodgers, Randall Cobb, and James Jones for 118 yards, but just 4 of 8 when throwing to Devontae Adams. How's he coming along?
Yeah, that's a great stat. I didn't actually know that. That makes sense to me now, but until you said that, I actually hadn't thought about that at all. But yeah, Adams, he was interesting because he was heralded a lot in the offseason program as being the kind of the summer of the MVP. They thought he made some really big strides. He was kind of quiet for a portion of training camp, and it sort of came on a little bit later. I think there is some questions there as far as, you know, when they first drafted him, I was thinking he might be more in that James Jones mold. I know a lot of people drew those comparisons. They had the same receivers coach. I believe it was in college. And some people were talking, this guy's more of a possession-type receiver. I think the Packers see some big play potential in him, but it hasn't always been consistent. He had a big game last year against New England, and then the next four games in December, I think he had like something like 7 catches for 33 yards or something like that in those games. The Packers need him to be a difference maker now. He needs to be that number two receiver for them. And I think there's confidence that he will do that. But yeah, it seemed like there was some things against the Bears where there was a little bit of, you know, his timing was thrown off and there was a couple passes that weren't quite on the spot for him. I'm trying to remember exactly if they gave him of who was on him the most. They kind of alternated those cornerbacks. But yeah, they're going to need a lot out of him this year, especially, you know, as the season wears on, they're going to need him to be a big factor in this offense without Jordy Nelson.
Yeah, and Kenny mentioned that Richard Rodgers was kind of a big part of the game plan. What can you tell us about him? I know Aaron Rodgers makes tight ends kind of a big part of the game plan, I think. Is he kind of the go-to guy?
He is, definitely. And it was actually funny in the same practice that Bulaga, one of the reasons I didn't see the Bulaga injury right away is because I was watching Richard Rodgers because he suffered a stinger earlier in practice.
Oh, okay.
He did not show up on the injury report. Packers said he got to the rest of practice just fine, but that was kind of concerning because the thing is that the Packers, this is the first time in 5 years they haven't kept four tight ends or more on the roster. They only went with three, which is very uncharacteristic of Mike McCarthy's operation. They really like those guys, you know, both from a special teams perspective and two tight end sets. So if Rodgers goes down, they get considerably thin at that position with Andrew Corliss, who could be suspended at some point this season, and Kennard Backman, who's a pretty raw project that they got in the sixth round of the draft, Rodgers is the guy that needs to be the big contributor this year. And a lot of the stories we wrote in the offseason program and training camp was what he was doing in the red zone. And he was a big factor in a lot of the practices and preseason games that we saw in being able to really show, you know, he's always had these hands and he's always been a really good pass catcher. It's one of the reasons why the Packers took him in the third round last year. But the big question mark with him is his run blocking, which is pretty shoddy yet, and blocking in general. If he can get that taken care of, I can see this guy being an every down tight end for this offense. But especially in the red zone right now, I think Rodgers has a lot of confidence in him. And I think that is a guy throughout the course of the season, you're going to see him be a factor down there in getting some opportunities to make some plays on balls.
In week one, we consistently saw Matt Forte gain 5, 6, 8, sometimes 20 yards on a rush against the Packers defense. Was that a product of Forte having a great game, or is this something that Marshawn Lynch and the Seahawks might be able to exploit on Sunday?
No, I think it's something that they're going to be able to exploit unless the Packers put a stop to it. Clay Matthews even said this week when we were talking to him, if I'm Marshawn Lynch and I'm the Seahawks, I'm liking the film that you're seeing right now from Green Bay. It wasn't pretty. 189 total rushing yards allowed until the Minnesota Vikings gave up 230 on Monday Night Football. That was the most allowed in week one. And the most troublesome part for me when I went back and watched the game and obviously, you know, looked further into this is it really wasn't just one player. It wasn't like the defensive line was capsizing or the linebackers weren't getting there. It was a lot of bad angles. It was a lot of missed tackles, and it was a lot of not being able to get guys down on first, or more specifically, get Forte down on first contact. McCarthy this week said, you know, they're emphasizing fundamentals. They think everything that happened in that game is correctable. The one thing that I'm kind of, that's in the back of my mind that I'm interested to see, both specifically in this game against Lynch and then next week against Jamal Charles, is do the Packers just have enough playmakers defensively? Because sometimes when you see these things happen where it isn't just one area of the defense that's collapsing, sometimes it just comes down to just not having great personnel. And they need playmakers right now. You have one in Matthews. You have another one in Peppers. But aside from that, they need somebody else to emerge. And whether that is one of these young inside or outside linebackers or someone in the secondary, that's going to be, I think, the key for this Packers defense improving throughout the course of the season. The one area where they definitely hurt, Morgan Burnett, their starting safety, is mostly an in-the-box kind of guy, a very good run tackler, and pretty productive in that side of things. They didn't have him. Ha ha, Clinton Dix was down there instead. He's usually playing the free role and took a couple of bad angles and had some missed tackles. So I think if they get Burnett back this week from a calf injury, that'll make a big impact and be a big help for this defense. But overall, they gotta prove that they can be difference makers back there if they're really going to be the defense they think they can be this season.
You mentioned Sam Barrington earlier. He suffered a foot injury and lost for the season. From what I'd heard is he's a little bit of a strong run defender, and that kind of goes, you know, that actually gives the Seahawks a little bit more of an advantage. Who have they got replacing him, and what can they expect from him?
Yeah, and I wrote a story this week on, I think, the day that we found out about it on Tuesday, that although Jordy Nelson is the name everyone's going to talk about, Sam Barrington, losing him is almost on the same level just because they can't replace him. They're very thin at inside linebacker. They didn't do much this offseason to address that position. You saw in, you know, the final minutes of that NFC title game when Clay Matthews was off the field, they ruptured. I mean, AJ Hawk, I know he was dealing with an ankle injury that was kind of hidden under the carpet, and, you know, Brad Jones, they couldn't get the job done with those guys. They cut both of them this offseason. They let Jamari Lattimore walk, but they only drafted Jake Ryan. They passed on free agency. They didn't use any high round picks on that position. Because they thought Barrington could be that guy next to Matthews. Obviously, Matthews is a big part of that game plan. They're using him inside very frequently now.
Okay.
But the thing about Barrington is he was a pretty good run defender, you know, in the base 3-4 and also in the nickel, you know, their big nickel packages. There was bigger question marks there as far as his coverage ability. I didn't think he was a natural dime linebacker because the Packers like to use Matthews as a rusher on those passing downs. Now it turns over to Nate Palmer, who was drafted around before Barrington in 2013. He started at outside linebacker. He moved inside now. He was originally a middle linebacker when he went to Illinois originally before he transferred. So he's the next guy up there. And then they also have Ryan, the fourth round pick out of Michigan. But outside of those two, those are the only guys on the roster right now that are actual inside linebackers. They have two guys on the practice squad, but otherwise they'd have to make an adjustment. So it's going to be Palmer, and he's going to have to play at a high level if Packers are going to have any success.
Just before, and I just realized earlier when you said "ha, Clinton Dix," that if you're talking to someone, all of a sudden out of nowhere, it sounds like they're sarcastically laughing at you. And it's just like, whoa, hold on. But just before we had you on, Danny and I were just gushing, you know, over Aaron Rodgers. I mean, it's hard not to just be so impressed with what he's been able to do. However, since 2012, when the Packers and Seahawks have both been at the top of the NFC, the Packers are 0-3 against Seattle. All of those games coming in Seattle, this one being in Green Bay. And something else is, over the last 3 years, Aaron Rodgers has thrown 55 touchdowns and only 5 interceptions at home. What makes Aaron Rodgers so damn hard to beat at home? He's great on the road. What hits that extra note that all of a sudden he's just so unstoppable in Lambeau?
Yeah, that's been a big question for us too, as Green Bay media this week, asking McCarthy and his quarterbacks coach Alex Van Pelt. You know, they do look at it in terms of, I wouldn't say like Green Bay is like the huge, giant, impenetrable home advantage. It's not that they're the loudest in the league. Obviously, I think Seattle does a pretty good job at holding that down. But there is something about Lambeau Field that just seems to mesh well with Rodgers. There was a time where a lot of people were wondering whether or not that this guy was more of a dome quarterback and if he could play outdoors, but he's really adapted well. And this offensive line and just these receivers, they're just built so much towards his strengths. And they've done an excellent job. It's one of the reasons why they were the highest scoring offense last season and had such a historic year in 2011. A lot of these same guys are together, particularly on the offensive line with TJ Lang and Brian Bulaga. And, you know, obviously we have to see what happens with him and Josh Sitton, an all-pro. The communication factor, I think, plays a lot into that. And there's just a lot of comfort being at home. And probably much like, you know, when you look at the Seahawks, too, with how well they've traditionally been almost unbeatable on their own field. So I don't think it's something where opposing teams come in here and they just can't solve it. But Rodgers just takes such an unbelievable job of taking care of the football. It's ridiculous. I mean, I saw that stat earlier this week about, you know, right now with where he's at, he's the only quarterback in NFL history that has 4 times as many touchdowns as interceptions, and nobody else has more than 3-1 in that category.
Insane.
So I think there's a comfort level there, and I think it probably just helps from the communication standpoint of making sure that, you know, the errors are as minimized as possible.
Now, you can correct me if I misheard something, but I felt like during the offseason I had heard that the Packers were talking about going a little more up-tempo this year. I think last year they decided to go a little slower. And then at the beginning of this year, the first game, they definitely didn't like – it wasn't a lot of up-tempo stuff against the Bears. What's the story with that? What did they want to be on offense in that sense?
Well, I know last year, going into last season, they actually were trying to go very up-tempo. The stories got out there about how McCarthy wanted to run 70 plays a game, and they did not meet that mark at all. They ended up coming out very slow out of the gate. This offseason, they changed a lot of the way that they structure their offseason program. Players really don't want to talk about it too much. I've noticed McCarthy is always kind of holds his, you know, cards close to his vest too.
Yeah.
But one thing you can tell is that, you know, they went out the first preseason game and they ran their offense basically the first half, at least the first full quarter. I think they ended up running like 33 plays, and they sort of tapered from there. As in the past, they've usually run a lot of their starters in that third preseason game. And I think that probably played into it a little bit, that McCarthy has been reiterating all throughout the offseason that he wants to get off to a fast start. They want to push the tempo. One of the reasons why they made this switch now, where he's handling just, you know, the overseer role and assistant head coach, Tom Clements is handing play calling, is so they can kind of streamline some things. I don't know if they look extremely different than what they have in the past. In many ways, they probably look the same. But I think it comes down to really trying to, again, push the tempo, have communication at an absolute maximum, and making sure that, you know, no you know, T's or I's get left uncrossed or dotted along the line. So, at the end of the day, the Packers, and it probably plays into your last question too, one of the reasons I think probably they do play well at home is they really do tend to push the tempo more. They don't huddle as much. They stay in their no huddle. And a lot of times, you know, with the way Aaron Rodgers is made up and his ability to adjust calls at the line of scrimmage, it's an extremely difficult matchup for opposing defenses.
If this game is as close as the NFC Championship or the 2012 quote-unquote fail Mary game, it's very possible that the difference will be a special teams play. Before the draft, a lot of Seahawks fans were getting excited about Ty Montgomery. We ended up with Ty Lockett, and we're more than happy with him. How is Ty Montgomery looking so far?
He looked really good against Chicago. Explosive. You know, I heard some stuff coming out of the draft that maybe, you know, I could say, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think he was pretty impressive as a junior, and then maybe his last year there, he took a step back, and I think there were some scouts out there that thought maybe he put on a little bit too much weight, and it took away some of his explosiveness. You know, at 6 foot, I think he's about 216, if I remember correctly. He's kind of an interesting football player, and in the analogy and the comparison that was thrown out right away from Packers West Coast scout Sam Seal was comparing him to Randall Cobb, and that's really stuck with him. And I don't know if he's going to end up being the explosive playmaker that Cobb is, but when you look at the kick return game, which the Packers were the second lowest in the league last year in production, Montgomery, I think, can give them a very big boost like Cobb did, very much like how he did in 2011 when he was drafted in the second round. His first two kickoff returns against Chicago, I think, went for 41 and 46, which either tied, and then the 46 one actually beat out their longest return from last season. That was the thing, is that Rodgers in this offense many times was having to go, you know, 80, you know, 85, 80 yards every time to score, and they wanted to shorten that up this year. Obviously, the Packers special teams problems were magnetized. You know, really, you know, you saw them in that game in Seattle in the NFC title game. So Montgomery was a part of this rebuilding plan of it, and I think so far he looked really good, much like Lockett. I think both those guys really have some significant upside as far as being playmakers on that third phase.
I think that most people kind of view the Packers as a high-volume passing team, whether that's right or wrong, but they also have a strong running game, and they have one of the toughest running backs in the NFL in Eddie Lacy. I know Michael Bennett, Seahawks defensive tackle today, said Eddie Lacy is, quote, slightly overweight, but he's also he thinks he's the second hardest guy to bring down in the NFL behind Marshawn Lynch. What makes him so tough to bring down?
I got to find that quote, by the way. That's fantastic. He's listed at 230, and I think that's a generous estimate on the roster. But the thing is that it doesn't slow him down. I mean, maybe at some point, you know, he's got to get 27, 28, 29. But you know what? 25 years old right now, he's at the peak of his power. And he's just explosive, man. And he is difficult to get down. The biggest difference when we talk about how you guys prompted it originally with the pass-oriented offense, 2011, 2012, it seemed like right up, you know, the Packers started off 13-0 that year. They were just rolling. And then they meet up with Kansas City, who was terrible that season for the most part. Romeo Crennel had already taken over. But they threw that cover two look at him. And then after that, the end of the 2011 season, into 2012, the Packers didn't have a respectable enough running game to be able to take people out of those two-shell looks. And it really hurt this offense and struggled to be as explosive as it was early in that 2011 season. Finally, Ted Thompson, the first time in his tenure as general manager, went out, invested a big draft pick in Eddie Lacy. Obviously, he did it once before with Brandon Jackson way back in 2007. But Lacy we're talking about a guy that probably should have been in the first round. And there was questions about his foot and his health overall. But just the way he plays this game, it added that final dimension that I think really completes this offense and allows, you know, the Packers to draw a safety into the box and be able to have those explosive over-the-top plays. He's amazing, and whether it's the spin move, the explosiveness, his ability not to go down after first contact, it's the best running back I've seen in here at least since Amon Green in the early 2000s, and he's certainly, whatever weight he's running at right now, it's definitely working for him.
And I think Seahawks fans would say you're welcome for Amon Green, but and it's weird to look back at Clay Matthews' best season and see that he had 13 and a half sacks, considering that now we have Justin Houston and J.J. Watt just destroying everything. But, you know, 2010, Clay Matthews is on top of the world. He's 24. He's an all-pro. He's a star. He's highest-selling jersey. Then things started to just sort of lose their luster a little bit, maybe. Maybe it's because of these other sack numbers and whatnot. But then Clay Matthews moved inside last year. How is Clay Matthews looking as he's moving around? Is he still as dangerous today at 29 as he was when he was 23, 24?
Yeah, he is, and the Packers need him to be. I mean, if there's any let up there from Matthews, this defense is going to suffer. He he's the central playmaker. He's the central component. You know, he's had some run-ins. I think those years when you talk about some of the down years and, you know, 2013, he broke his thumb twice and missed some action. He's had a hamstring issue in the past. There have been injuries there that have slowed him, but, I would put that second half of his season last year up against any, you know, eight, 10 game stretch of his career. That defense and this team maybe doesn't even make that NFC title game if it's not for that switch. The Packers were last in the league during their bye week in week 9 against the run. I think they were like 26 overall. Things were not going in the right direction. A.J. Hawk just wasn't the same player anymore, and he'd always had his limitations to begin with. Moving Matthews inside, and they gave him 3 days during the bye week to learn that position.
Wow.
Moving him inside, that changed their season. And it made him a lot more explosive, too. He only had 2.5 sacks at the bye week. And, you know, with the way they used him in that second half, even if he wasn't, you know, always on the line of scrimmage, it made him a more explosive player. And the analogy I keep trying to use is that, you know, he was one of the league's better pass rushers when he was just doing that. This gives him the ability to be one of the league's best defensive players. And I don't know how he feels about that spot. I know how much he likes rushing off the edge. But the fact of the matter is, you saw it late in that Chicago game. Even when the Packers struggled as much as they did, the way he came out of nowhere to pick off that pass from Cutler and bring it back 42 yards, not everybody does that. And I don't know if he's ever going to surpass 13 sacks again. I don't know if he's going to have that opportunity. But for the Packers defense and this team to get where it needs to be this season, he has to be in the middle of the field whether he likes it or not. And certainly right now, I think that he's given them a really good performance, and he should at least be seeing the upside of what this move can do for him as well.
I think if there was one game in 2014 that was, or I guess it was in 2015, but the 2014 season, if there was one game that was more depressing than the Super Bowl ending for a fan base, it was probably the NFC Championship game ending for the Packers. What was the offseason like for you guys?
Oh, I mean, I to be honest with you, and I don't want to overblow this, but I still think people are reeling to some extent.
yeah.
Here's the thing. It wasn't just the Seahawks. The Packers couldn't get past San Francisco before that either. Mm. And in 2011, it was the New York Giants who were their undoing, and then the Giants go on to win the Super Bowl. It just seems like the last four seasons the Packers have, since they won the Super Bowl, have always been the second best team. And yeah. Last year, it finally looked like everything came together. Yeah, Aaron Rodgers had the torn calf muscle, and he wasn't his usual self. But the defense was playing perhaps as well as it has under Dom Capers' entire tenure in that game. Everything was going right. The first half, Russell Wilson had more completions to Packers cornerbacks than he did his own receivers. That was the game that I think everybody thought, hey, the Packers are finally doing this. They're going back to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And for it to be such a beautiful disaster there at the end, where it just everything falls apart, whether it was offense not being able to move the ball after Morgan Burnett's interception, the defense giving up after containing Lynch and Wilson the entire game, just completely letting go there in the final minutes. And then obviously the special teams play there with Bostic botching that onside kick. I think we counted it. There were 16 plays that really, if any of those go a different direction, the Packers probably win that game.
Wow.
It didn't happen, though. They have to put this thing behind them. And I think I talked to a lot of those guys in the locker room afterwards and early in this offseason program. It took a long time, I think, for that whole grieving process to end. Clay Matthews even talked about it this week. Pete Carroll, when he was in our conference call, also mentioned that sometimes you just got to give guys space and come back. But that's the thing. With how close the Packers were last year and now with Rodgers 31 going on 32 this season, it's not that the window's closing, but I think Packer fans, they want to get back to the promised land. And for a lot of them, for 55 minutes and whatever that was, 56 seconds, it looked like last year was going to be the season, and it certainly wasn't.
Yeah, and Green Bay seems like such a nice town. And, you know, I recently read, you know, someone's their thoughts were if the NFL had started in 1960 instead of 1920, the Packers wouldn't exist because it's not a place that NFL is typically looking to put a team. But now, of course, they've built such a thing with that sort of, and, you know, with the fans owning the team with that hometown feel, do you think Brandon Bostic could go down to Titletown Brewing Company down on Dousman Street and get Milwaukee's best without getting harassed?
Yeah, I think so. You also have to understand people in Green Bay, at least from I've lived here my entire life, I know there was a lot of things said to Brandon on Twitter, a lot of bad things too. I know you read probably read the MMQB story, and you know, and when he talked about it, you know, the death threats and things like that. But it just seems like whenever people are in public, they're still in awe of these Packer players. I mean, this is a 100,000, almost 200,000, you know, person community, depending on which metro district you want to talk about, in the suburbs and whatnot. It's a small community, and they really rally around their team. And whether it's an injury or, you know, some kind of, you know, setback, I think in a lot of times they are pretty forgiving. I'm sure if you got the right Packer fan that maybe had a few cocktails in them, they might say something not great. Yeah. But for the most part, and I can't speak for Brandon, I don't know how much he's been here since then, but it just seems like there, in a lot of ways, people did sort of sympathize with him a little bit in that situation. And this is the thing I've always said, because Sean Slocum lost his job over that play. Their special teams coach was fired. Bostic was cut about a month after the game. I still kind of question, too, why Bostic was ever in that position to begin with, just because it seemed like they had a better option than Justin Frillo on the practice squad, and Bostic had a really down season. It wasn't like this was this big special teams ace that just kind of out of nowhere played bad. I mean, Bostic had a pretty bad season all in general. When we did our final grades, I had to give him an F, you know, and they were expecting him to be a big part of the offense, and he wasn't. Special teams, he really didn't have much of an impact. So now it's tough. I mean, he has to go out there and play his job and pay attention to what he's supposed to do, but at the end of the day, it was also the Packers that made him one of their game day 46, and that's something that could happen.
Yeah, I wonder if all that was running through his mind on that play when he's like, well, I can make up for it right now.
That's not a good way of going at it. I was going to just say, I think it's going to be an interesting game from a narratives or just storylines point of view. It's kind of two teams reeling from horrific losses. You know, last year, obviously the Seahawks lost their first game this year and the Packers won, but I still think it, like you said, like people are reeling a little bit in Green Bay. People are definitely still in that mode, I think, in Seattle after the final play of the Super Bowl.
You know, not to interrupt you, but
yeah, go ahead.
I don't see how you couldn't be. You know, and I know the Packers are saying all the right things. I'm sure Seattle's saying the right things too about how that was last year. This is a new team. We move forward. But I can tell you guys right now, the one time that I lost my fantasy football title by like a point and a half, I've always thought about that for the last 8 years. And that's fantasy football. I mean, if something like this, with as much that's on the line and how difficult it is to get there, I don't see how you can't reel from it. I don't think it's a sign of weakness. I don't think it's, you know, something where it's like you can't get over it. I can see why it would be difficult. The one thing you have to hedge against, and the one thing that I'm sure the Packers don't want to give off that vibe, is that you don't want it to make it look like it's something that you're just continually dealing with and
right.
You can't get over.
Right.
But I think sometimes when we send these narratives too of, well, we're moving on, I don't think that's always necessarily, I understand why they're doing it, but I don't think it's completely reprehensible if, you know, you do think of all these things, because it is a tough loss and we're all human, you know, and
exactly.
There's always going to be that room for error. And that's the reason why this game and this league is as popular as it is right now, because sometimes it is something like that. The simplest of plays or the smallest of calls that ended up making the biggest difference.
Well, I think that if Seattle goes into Green Bay this weekend and loses, fans will be able to handle it. You know, even being 0-2, they'll say to themselves, you know, that it's at Green Bay. You just can't beat Aaron Rodgers at home. How do you think the Packers are going to handle it, or the Packers fans are going to handle it, if they lose this game?
You know, the thing that's going to be interesting about it is the Packers have an opportunity here to, you know, they have a pretty, I don't want to say light schedule, but it's a favorable schedule. Over the last few years, they've kind of struggled a little bit with, you know, they had Seattle right away and San Francisco. Maybe Packer fans would take it a little bit too seriously just because, you know, they've lost the last three against Seattle and they couldn't beat them at CenturyLink. So if we can't beat them here, what does that mean? Excuse me. But I also think you have to look at it the other way too. If the Packers win this game and end up losing them again in the playoffs, it doesn't make it any easier. And if the Packers, you know, lose this game and finally end up beating them, no one's ever even going to think about this game. So as important as this is, I still think we're looking at two playoff teams here. And while it might matter for home field advantage and you know, those kind of considerations, it is just week two. So I can definitely see that argument.
Well, Weston, we really want to thank you for coming on our podcast. That was hugely informative and entertaining. Tell people where they can find you on Twitter and on the net.
Well, just to make everybody's life easier, I went with at Wes Hod, not my full last name, just HODWESHOD. And then obviously PackersNews.com is our website. GreenBayPressGazette.com is our full newspaper site, so you can find all of our great stuff there.
Awesome. And also, it also works as We Shod, at We Shod, if that helps people.
That's why I made sure to capitalize.
Perfect. All right. Thanks, Weston.
Yeah, really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, that was Wes Hod, We Shod, Weston Hodkowitz. That was great. He was definitely very, very informative. He knows his team. He knows his football. And that was great.
Yeah. Has your confidence gone up or down based on that conversation?
You know, to be honest, it's stayed about the same. I think maybe my confidence in the Seahawks' ability to run has even gone up a little bit. And that was kind of how I decided to go with the Seahawks. So I guess in that sense, I'm feeling a little bit better. But, you know, at the same time, talking about Aaron Rodgers so much kind of dampens my enthusiasm, I think, a little bit, you know, because he's just so good. And, you know, so it's going to be interesting to see what happens on Sunday.
Yeah, I definitely – you don't root now I realize that as I make this transition, it'll sound like I'm talking about Rodgers, but let me get through it. You don't root for someone to get injured or you don't celebrate an injury, but hearing that Sam – not having Sam Barrington is a big deal definitely gives me a lot more confidence as well.
Right. It's yeah, I mean, I didn't really know the impact that he was making in terms of there's no depth behind him. So that's big, I think. And you know, that's something that if there's one or two things you can take away from this podcast, I think is one is the middle linebacker spot is something to really watch for the Packers this week. That's going to be kind of a big deal. So,
The last time that Aaron Rodgers lost at home was in the 2013 playoffs against the San Francisco 49ers.
That's the game where he ran all over them, right, Cap?
Yeah, this one, Colin Kaepernick, he ran 7 times for 98 yards.
Oh, that's not what I was thinking. Okay.
Yeah, he did have another one where it was like 150 or 181 yards, I think.
Yeah.
But still, 227 yards passing, 98 yards rushing. Michael Crabtree had 8 catches for 125 yards. Aaron Rodgers, not as effective, 7 of 26 for 177 yards in that playoff loss. Aaron Rodgers has been a lot more human in the playoffs, I've found. Mm. But he's only lost 2 home games, not in the regular season dating back to 2012, that being one of them. But then also one of the other ones was against the Chicago Bears, which doesn't really count because that was the game in which he got hurt. And then they went 2-5-1 while he was out with Matt Flynn.
I remember that.
So I'm just trying to look for some sort of salvageable hope here. And then week one of 2012, they lost at home to San Francisco as well. So the 49ers have, you know, the 49ers, their road record, we talked about this briefly, but the 49ers road record over the last few years has really been impeccable, how they can go to the east side and still perform almost better than they do at home. But
they're a tough team.
Yeah, we'll see if that continues. And that other home loss, Alex Smith was 20 of 26 for 211 yards, 2 touchdowns. Frank Gore had 16 carries for 112 yards. And Aaron Rodgers was 30 of 44 for 303 yards, 2 touchdowns and an interception. Yeah, I think the Seahawks, if they can get maybe one turnover or just not, you know, give up 300 yards passing, that would probably go a long ways towards beating the Packers.
Yeah, I think the Seahawks, you know, it's funny because I think the Seahawks are definitely good enough to win. I picked them to win, obviously, but and they're a good enough team to go on the road and beat a good team like this. I think just right now it just feels weird. You know, the Seahawks, it just feels like they're reeling a little bit, whether it's because they lost in week one, because of the constant drama over the offseason, you know, like we talked about with Wes, you know, the mental hurdle it takes to get over a game like the end of the Super Bowl. It's just, you know, it's just kind of a weird feeling right now for the Seahawks. It'd be great to really see them get back to like that kick you in the face like a mentality sort of identity this week, because I know that's like you know, it's like a fun team to root for when they're so tough and physical and really just kind of beat up on teams. So that's kind of what I'll be looking for. It was funny when I was when I was asking Wes to tell people to tell him where to find him on the net, I could hear you giggling in the background. I don't know.
You're like Sandra Bullock in the film.
Do people still call it the net? I guess that's probably an outdated.
If you're watching the movie The Net with Sandra Bullock.
The web? Anyhow.
Yeah, the World Wide Web. I think I pride myself on my optimism. It came in a lot more handy like in 2011. You know, now these days, like, people tend to be more optimistic because the Seahawks have been so successful over the last 2.5 years. I don't think that this one loss, I don't think the feelings are any different. They're probably better than if you go back to the loss to the Lions in 2012 that dropped them to 6-5, or the loss to Kansas City last year that dropped them to 6-4. I mean, we're talking about 0-1. Really, they did a lot of things right, and then they just couldn't execute. Why? Like, as Brock,
yeah, they really should have won.
They really should have won. And if you looked at Brock Heward's Chalk Talk this week, he pretty much detailed a lot of reasons why it was the proper call, and that when they had the matchups, every offensive coordinator or whatever would die for that matchup that they had. And simply put, what else can you say other than, you know, J.R. Sweezy can't guard Aaron Donald or whatever? I mean,
people kind of, I think, you know, obviously the whole Bevel argument goes back further than one play. But people were kind of using this one play as like a, you know, starting point to talk about how he should be fired. But it's like, at some point, you kind of have to rely on your players to execute as well. And that was one of their most successful plays throughout the whole game. It's one of their most successful plays over the last 3 years. You're giving it to your best player, potentially, in Marshawn Lynch. And sometimes players just screw up. And that's kind of just how I looked at it. Like, it was a big situation. Obviously there was a lot on the line, and they just got beat up front. The scheme was there. They got the matchups they wanted. They got the look they wanted, and they just didn't execute. And there's so many plays in a game. It's like, man, you really can't, you know, it's just like, it doesn't come down to one play. It's similar sort of narrative to the Super Bowl as well. It's like, you know, if you don't give up a 10-point lead, we're not in the position to throw that interception on the 1 yard line or whatever. So, I think people who, and I'm not pulling the, you know, if you've never played football card, but like people who played football will know, like, a game is a chaotic, long series of very violent collisions. There's like a million moving parts. There's 100 guys on, you know, like, you know, 100 guys against each other, 53 guys on each team. There's just a lot of moving parts and a lot of plays throughout a game and emotions and moods and like mood swings and motive, blanking on the word here.
Yeah. I think
momentum, momentum swings, motivation.
You lost your momentum, but
I did. But yeah, I mean, like the game of football is just chaos, man. So,
I think that most teams, the standard deviation between a great team and a bad team, I think you can get pretty far away. I think that, you know, you can definitely say that the Seahawks were a really, really much better team than the Jaguars last year. But at the same time, I think the middle 25 teams are pretty close. And it's like, so
yeah, there's so much parity.
And when you talk about, oh, the Seahawks, like if you have a power ranking that, you know, or whatever, and it's like, well, this team is 5 and this team is 8, like there's interchangeable. And so it's like there's no reason to think that. And I think that the Seahawks, and like I was saying before, like I've always been sort of an optimist, but I definitely think that I would say that I believe the Seahawks will win this week, and then people are going to be like, they're just going to be back to being normal or fine or whatever. And then they'll freaking lose to the Bears at home. And people, if they lose to the Bears or Lions at home, I'd be a hell of a lot more worried losing to the Rams in St. Louis.
Yeah. And it's funny what you said about the power rankings, because I actually, you know, I do the power rankings for SB Nation. I do spend a lot of time looking around, studying it and tinkering with it and feeling it out. And like people, I don't want people to think that I like take it lightly, but at the same time, it's like, you know, I don't read the comments because it's such like inane arguments. Oh, why is this team above this team? It's like, whatever. I could probably interchange number 5 through number 25 and no one would fucking care. Like it's right. Like someone would think it was correct. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
But that said, I do spend a lot of time on it and take it seriously, but I just think, like you said, there's so much parity in the league that, you know, you could make arguments for just about any team. So,
yeah, I remember the unpower rankings. I forgot about those. Those were, I thought the only reason that that was fun for me was just because it was more of a way to just dig on teams more so than say who was than someone else. I always seem to have more fun making fun of teams than praising them, but
that's totally fair.
I think that pretty much wraps it up for.
Yeah, we got a little off target there at the end, but cool.
No, I think that's when Real on the Field Goals, RITFG, is at its best. So it's been a long episode, but a very helpful and informative one. And, you know, if you want to come back after the game on Sunday night, I guess me and Danny will have to be recording that one around 9 p.m. But then you'll be able to listen to it on Monday morning. If you're subscribed to Real on the Field Goals on iTunes, that would be the best way to do it. So please hit that up. The numbers have been looking great. You guys like the show. So that means that I expect someone to start telling the Ballard agency that Field Goal sent you. So get on that. You know, if you any type of insurance, you know, as a broker, just go to call the number 425-454-3510 and tell them Field Goal sent you. One of these days I'm going to get Danny to sing the jingle. That's all there is to it. That's the end of the day.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.